session number 29054, Mr. Bim Wells, Reel 7. Now, you say the training finished then, so when would this be? What month is this?
This is round about the end of November.
44, of course.
Let me just, course 19.
It is 44, yeah.
Yeah, early part, about the first 10 days of I see my logbook was signed on the 11th of November when we left Lewiston. We then went to New York, a couple of nights there, and then we boarded the Aquitania, which was a not a naval ship, it was a liner which had been used for troop carrying. And in addition to, there were only about 10 of us Fleet Air Arm personnel, and the rest, there was a US infantry division being shipped over to join the war in Europe. As I say, this was December 44, and we came back again under our own steam with no escort or anything. They just used the zigzag course at speed.
You mean November 44?
Yeah, and we arrived at Gourock, which is just off on the west coast of Scotland near Glasgow, and back to UK for the first time in just over a year, I suppose. And they wanted to ship us straight down to Lancashire, a place called Inskip, to continue our training there. But we said, now look, we've been away from England, we've not seen our families and something for over 12 months, surely we're entitled to at least a 48-hour pass. And after all our protests, they did eventually give us a 48-hour pass to just to come home and then back to Inskip. Where
now, what was it at Inskip? Was that I don't know that.
This was a Royal Naval airfield. Inskip is about midway between Preston and Blackpool in Lancashire, and we were there joined by some rather more senior officers than we were. There was a couple of Lieutenant RN people and three other Lieutenant RMVR people, and we carried on with the same sort of training, glide bombings, dummy deck landings, fair amount of night flying. In fact, one of our people who had trained with us one night flew out on an exercise over the Irish Sea. We don't know to this day what happened, but he hit a shipping vessel, small one, with a crew of about 8 or 9, and he killed himself, his two crew, and all the people on the ship. And I know the following morning I was sent out with one of the senior pilots to do a search over the Irish Sea looking for wreckage, and that, and all we found were, you know, a few oil drums and this sort of thing. And he was a good friend of mine who had trained with me all the way through, really. So, as I say, we carried on this training at Inskip. I know I had to take some passages up to a place called Macrahanish in Scotland, and we then had to go and do some more deck landings in the Clyde. And that was when the other ship I mentioned, which was it the Smiter?
So that's another.
And this was, we had to do these deck landings on there before we were allowed to go on embarkation leave.
Now, how did those deck landings go? Any problems, or was it?
I didn't have any problems. I again did the four, and I was given an assessment of 5+, which is slightly above average. I remember one of our chaps, lost power and had to ditch, and he got his number one suit on, and he got out of the aircraft, and they sent a boat to pick him up, and all he got wet was his ankles and his shoes, basically, and he sort of stepped off the wing of the aircraft into the boat, and we were then... it was the HMS Smiter, the landings we did in the Clyde, and we were then sent off on leave, extended leave, you know, for about, I don't know, 2 or 3 weeks.
Now, what was your embarkation leave like?
Well, I came home, obviously, and had a bit of a good time. This friend of mine, who I'd trained with all the time, who lived at Whittick in Leicestershire, his father was a police sergeant, we'd formed a very close relationship, and towards the end of January I got my posting, which was to, by this time I'd turned the age of 20, and I was then made a temporary acting sub-lieutenant A, RMVR, which is about as low as you can get. And I received this posting from the Lord High Admiral of the United Kingdom to say that I was to join 828 Squadron at HMS Sparrowhawk, which in fact was a Royal Naval Air Station at Hatston near Kirkwall in the Orkney Islands. And I remember ringing this friend of mine and saying, have you got your posting? So I said, yeah, I'm joining 828 Squadron in the Orkneys. He said, well, I'm going to a place I've never heard of. It was Katakarunda. It's in Ceylon, as it was in those days. So I said, oh, right, well, we'll see one another sometime, you see, and that was it. And I remember getting on a train over at Rugby, just inside Warwickshire, took me right up to Thurso in northern Scotland, when I got on a little coastal ship that took me up to the island of Kirkwall in the Orkneys to join 828 Squadron. Now, 828 Squadron had just come back from doing a bombing attack on the Tirpitz, which was hiding in a Norwegian fjord, and they had been using Barracuda dive bombers. And it was at this time that the CNC of the British Pacific Fleet in the Far East said, Barracudas are no good in tropical conditions. I want all Barracuda squadrons who are destined for the Far East to convert to Avengers. So I arrived in the Orkney Islands, and they'd just received these Avengers, which were Mark 1 Avengers, which weren't particularly good, and they were converting from these Barracudas onto Avengers. And I think I got more hours on Avengers than the rest of the squadron put together. But and of course the problem was up there, again it was January when I went up there, everything seemed to happen to me in January. And it was a lot colder than, of course, than it was in Florida or even in Lewiston. And they were having trouble getting these engines to start even up there. Anyway, we started the same sort of exercise, although I was more experienced, quite honestly, than most of the other pilots in the squadron.
Now, you still had your observer with you?
I still had, Tony Younger, yeah. And by this time, I got another air gunner called Leading Airman Durnell, D-U-R-N-E-L-L. And
now, did he stick with you for?
He stuck with
now,
me.
Now, what was he like?
Well, I got on well with him because I was able to say to these air gunners, "Look, I started off my career as an air gunner, and I've always got a soft spot for air gunners because I know what it's like if you went to Butlin's Holiday Camp Skegness for a start, you've got my sympathy." And he was all right. He you know, he used to call me sir, which is fair enough.
He was a leading hand, was he?
A leading hand. Talking about...
do you remember his first name?
No, I'm sorry, I can't after all these years.
What was he like as a chap? Was he a good rear gunner?
Well, he was. He was. The thing was, you didn't see a lot of the air gunners because the pilots and the reservers were in the officers' mess, of course, and the air gunners were in the leading hands quarters. So you only saw them really when you were flying, at that stage anyway. So. You didn't form that close a relationship with them because I was at the front doing the flying. He was in the turret at the back, and you had communication through the intercom and that. But you didn't really mix with them that much, if you see what I mean. Not at that stage. When you get on board a ship, it's slightly different.
So you're doing the usual exercises, gunnery, dive bombing,
formation,
torpedoes.
Yeah. And we then moved from, after, only about 2 or 3 weeks, we flew down to Scotland, a place called Fearn, F-E-A-R-N, which is in Rosshire, near the Cromarty Firth. And doing the old things like the Addles again, because most of the squadron never landed an Avenger on a carrier, and they got to go after all this Addles business. But I mean, I'd done it all before, so I was fairly happy with that, and we had a good time at Fearn, and we were there for, I don't know, 6 weeks, I should think.
So what, the February, Marchish?
Yeah, and then we were ordered to actually fly on board the Implacable, which was somewhere off the east coast of Scotland. And as I say, most of these chaps had never landed an Avenger on an aircraft carrier, but I by this time, I'd done 8 landings, you know. So they were tending, I don't know whether you know anything about landing, the Royal Naval landing procedure on carriers, but what you do is you go on you come up on the starboard side of the carrier, go straight ahead for about half a mile, you do a 180 degree turn, come on the downwind leg, and when you get level with the stern, or the round down as it's called on a carrier, you start doing your turn in and the batsman picks you up. But these other lads in the squadron who hadn't landed an Avenger were tending to come in rather like the Americans from about half a mile astern. But me being me, I did my sharp turn in, and he waved the others off and brought me on. And anyway, we did eventually get all the aircraft on, and we then set off. We did a sweep out into the Atlantic.
Where was she when you joined her?
Off the east coast of Scotland. And of course, as opposed to the previous landings I'd made on the carrier, the Implacable was a large fleet carrier of 32,000 tons.
Now, what she was like, can you give us a sort of picture? I mean, we've seen pictures of her, you've got a nice picture, you know. But what was she like as a ship? You know what I mean?
She was a beautiful ship, I'll say that about her. And the fact that it had got about 800 feet of flight deck, it looked quite large compared with the other ships that I had made landings on. And I know that people who were on the ship at the same time as me have written books about their time on the Implacable, and one of them in particular said it was the happiest ship he'd ever served on. Because a lot of the senior officers were made up of Fleet Air Arm personnel who had been on things like Taranto and the Malta runs, experienced people who had done their time when, I suppose, flying in the Fleet Air Arm was a much more concentrated and difficult job in the early part of the 1940s than it was when we were flying, really. Anyway, we did this sweep out into the Atlantic. I did a couple of anti-sub patrols, because although it was by this time March 45, there was still a danger of submarine attacks. And we then went into the Med. I did one.
Do you remember any of these? What was a typical anti-submarine patrol like? Just take us. What was it like?
Well, you flew ahead of the ship because there was just the Implacable and an attendant destroyer, which aircraft carriers always had. And I flew, I don't know, about 10 miles ahead of the ship and did a sort of patterned patrol, basically looking for submarines or a wash from a periscope. But, you know, I didn't see anything, but it was all part of the... of the exercise. And of course by this time, it's perhaps something I forgot to mention, the Avenger had got radar, of course, by this time, so you had the advantage of having a radar screen as well.
Now tell me about the radar, the use of radar. What training do you had, and what was the screen like?
It was quite a small screen, and you know...
Was it in your cockpit?
It was in my cockpit, yeah.
How did you use it? I mean, how efficient was it?
It was fairly basic stuff, but of course by this time I suppose the radar had improved tremendously, and we did have a number of exercises doing radar calibration and so on, and it was certainly an added aid to flying both during the day and during the night as well, I suppose.
Now, what was a calibration exercise like? What would you do on a calibration exercise?
Well, you'd pick up these objects on the screen and see if you could identify what sort of vessel you had picked up, you know, whether it was large or small or whether more than one, this sort of thing.
Did it pick up air things as well, or was it just sea?
I don't recall it picking up any air things, quite honestly, no. But... anyway, we went through the Med. We then had an overnight stop in Alexandria and then set off down the Suez Canal. And we took a pilot on board, an Egyptian pilot he was. When I say pilot, I mean a ship's pilot, not an aircraft pilot. And in the very narrowest part of the Suez Canal, he had to manoeuvre the ship round one of these Arab dhows, and the next thing we know, we've run aground in the Suez. 32,000 tons of aircraft carrier, and so there was no room because we'd slewed across the canal. We got a 15 degree list, and no other ships could go up or down the canal until they got us off this sort of sandbank we were on. And there were tugs arrived, and there was pushing and shoving most of the night, and they did eventually manage to get us off this thing and back into a situation where we could put power on again and get the ship moving. And
had you been damaged?
It was mainly a sandbank, as I say, and the fact that it had listed a bit, they did some sort of quick have a look at it and so on, but there was no serious damage, and we were able to continue. And we, after we got out of the bottom end of the canal and down the Red Sea, we went to Ceylon, Sri Lanka as it is now, to a place called Trincomalee, which was again a naval air station. And again, it was the same old routine, really, all part of working up the squadron, doing glide bombing, dive bombing, front gun firing, formation flying, all sorts of things like that.
They hadn't actually joined the Far East Fleet yet?
No, we were still on our own. And we were in Trincomalee, I don't know, probably about 6 weeks. And I think.
So when would this be?
This is April of 45. And I think I'd mentioned that this friend of mine who I trained with, when we got to Trincomalee, because of various things that had happened, accidents on the way out, because the problem with these aircraft we got, they were very underpowered, and there were a number of occasions when taking off the Implacable, the plane would disappear off the bow of the ship, and sometimes it staggered along just over the waves and gradually got into the air, and sometimes it never made it and went in. But by the time we got to Trincomalee, we needed four replacement crews, and we sent to a place called Katakarunda for these for replacement crews, and who should one of them be but my old friend Phil Meakin. So having said only about 3 months before that I'd see him sometime after the war, we were together again after that period of time.
Now, what was it like taking off from a carrier? Can you take me through it? I mean, what was it like?
It's fine when it's when the sea is calm, which isn't very often. But of course, certainly the Avenger had its wings folded backwards like that alongside the fuselage, and we always were situated on the stern of the carrier when there was a fly off, and then you'd have we had. Fairy Fireflies, which were fighter bomber type of thing, and then right at the front were the Sea Fires, because they were fairly light and didn't need so much of a run, so they used to get the Sea Fires off first, then the Fireflies, and then they'd bring the Avengers. And as you were brought up to the spot where you were going to do your rolling takeoff, you brought your wings up, they folded back in, brought them back and locked the wings in. And then the deck control officer would sort of say, right, you know, he'd point and say, go, like. Now, as I say, it's fine when the sea is calm, but when it's a bit rough and you're sitting there just sort of opposite the island on the carrier to do your run, if it's rough, the front of the carrier goes way down below the horizon and then comes all the way back up again. And what you had to do was to gauge when to start your run, so that by the time you got to the end of the deck, the deck was coming up, not going down. And it's surprising how easily you were able to gauge this. I think I started my run just as it was nearing its highest point, and then by the time it had gone down, it was then coming up again by the time you got to the end of the deck. And it worked quite well, I must admit. And but it was, as I say, extremely difficult when the sea wasn't calm and you didn't get that many calm seas. And the same thing applied, really, to landing on as well.
And what about the landing on? What about things like arrestor work? We've talked about landing on, but we haven't actually mentioned things and the batsmen. What about arrestor work? Did they use them?
Well, this, of course, is in the days before the angled deck. And there were 8 arrestor wires strung across the deck, hydraulically operated. They raised them up about that far, about 6 inches off the deck, I suppose. And then there was a 9th wire, which we used to call the Jesus Christ wire, because all the first 8 wires, as you landed on, the hydraulic sort of slowed the aircraft to a stop in about 30 or 40 feet, but the Jesus Christ wire was taut, and when you hit that, bang, it stopped you dead. And if you missed that, there was then a barrier, a hydraulically operated barrier, which was raised to a height of about 8-10 feet, I suppose. And if you missed all the wires, he went into the barrier.
And what was the barrier? Was it netting or what?
It was wire, strong steel wire. And it was what used to happen after you'd landed on, and if you were lucky enough to catch an arrestor wire, one of the deck handling crew would unhook the arrestor hook from the wire, and you then retracted it back into the aircraft because it was all done by switches and so on. And then they dropped the barrier, you taxied forward of the barrier, and they lifted the barrier, and then the next aircraft was ready to land on, you see. But they wouldn't let you land on until you were forward of the barrier. And
you had to hit, if you didn't hit an arrestor wire, you wouldn't stop then?
You'd either catch the Jesus Christ wire, and that usually tipped you up on your nose, or you just smashed into the barrier.
So there was no, I mean, it wouldn't just stop out in its own time, as it would on a normal airfield.
Oh, no.
Had to have an arrestor.
Yeah.
Was it the extra arrestor wire just hung from the... Where did they hang from?
Right out of the tail, underneath.
The hook, I mean.
Yes,
yeah.
It slid down and dropped like that. It was, I don't know, about that long.
As it
came out of the aircraft, the weight of it, and then it got like this big hook on the end, and that's what caught the wire. It was just the one hook, like, you know. And
now, when the wire, you've got the aircraft the other side of the barrier, what would happen to it then? I mean, would it just sit on the deck, or would it be sent down?
You either sat on the, sometimes either what they called a forward park, or you would fold your wings back, and the carrier had two lifts, one forward and one aft, and they'd put you onto the forward lift with your wings folded, and you'd then go down into the hangar.
So that's where they'd normally keep the aircraft?
If they were parking in forward of the barrier, you would just fold your wings back, cut the engine, and get out of it, like, really. In fact, you used to do that anyway, because the deck handlers would then put it onto the lift and get it down into the hangar. You know, you got out of the aircraft at that stage.
Right, so what happens next then? You're doing all this training.
Well, we then leave, we fly on board the carrier again off Ceylon, and we head for Australia. We called in at Fremantle on the west coast of Australia, which is quite near to Perth. We had a couple of days there while they refueled and did various things. And then we went along the south coast of Australia and round up towards Sydney. And I remember we actually flew onto this airstrip called Jervis Bay on the 8th of May 45, which I think is when hostilities ceased in Europe.
Now, how did you feel when you heard the news of V-Day? Was there any celebration?
Well, we thought it would all be over in a couple of months, and, you know, that would be it. But we were obviously delighted that the war had ended in Europe, but we did realise that there was still Japan, who were going to be tough opponents anyway.
Were there any actual celebrations, or was it pretty muted?
Oh, I think we had a bit of a booze up in the mess at night. In fact, the squadron went to an airstrip called Nowra, and a small number of us were sent to this satellite airstrip called Jervis Bay. And there were only about a dozen of us, I think, at this Jervis Bay, and the rest of the squadron were all over at Nowra. But they used to come over daily by truck to do the flying from this airstrip at Jervis Bay. And we were billeted in, there were about eight of us in this bungalow, which had been commandeered by the Navy. And we had a wonderful time there, because what we used to do was, while the rest of the squadron were driving the 50-odd miles over from the Nowra, we did our morning flights. Again, we were mainly doing high glide bombing and bombing runs and gunnery runs and this sort of thing. And we used to do these, as I say, first thing in the morning for about an hour, hour and a half perhaps. And then we were finished for the day, because by this time the rest of the squadron had come by truck from Nowra, and we used to go down on the beach. And the other thing about this, where we were billeted, there was no cooking facilities, so we used to go and eat in the local hotel, and it was absolutely magnificent. I've never ate such food in all my life, I think.